Welcome back to the second portion of today's 6 CEU seminar regarding supervision. As we continue, we're going to talk about the developmental nature of supervision. So early on, obviously when you get a supervisee who maybe has minimal experience, they may really feel the pressure of the lack of competence. They may have a number of questions and a sense of real insecurity. They may be so focused on asking questions about how do I deal with this client or this issue, or really need more of that didactic and teaching type of approach. But one of the things we want to do when we're looking at these different developmental levels is how to focus on the process, also how to look at the context of things. In terms of a very simplistic way of looking at the developmental stages of supervisees, the literature has suggested that there's essentially three different phases that supervisees go through. The first being stagnation, the second is confusion, and the third is integration. So usually when a more inexperienced supervisee comes to us, they feel like there's not a lot of awareness of what's going on underneath what's happening with the clients. They may have very concrete, all or nothing, black or white type of thinking. You know, what is it I need to do in this situation with this client? They may ask linear questions, so their problem solving and their solutions may be in line with thinking there's just one ideal, perfect, good, right way of doing things. Keep in mind, again, they're focused on this evaluative concept of what supervision is. They're going to have a high dependency on their supervisor, and seeing the supervisor as all-knowing or all-wise, because they may feel pretty inadequate and have a low self-concept. Over time, though, as we do both skill building and skill development, and we help highlight, and they develop and gain some sense of competency, they come to the second stage, which is more what they call confusion. And what we mean by that is there's this back and forth between part of them realizing, oh, maybe there is something I know. Maybe there's more skills that I have and things that I can do than I realized. So there's this fluctuation between this idea of I helped and I failed. So there's this realization, I don't have all the solutions. There's still areas I need to grow in. And I still really need some guidance by my supervisor. But I'm starting to get some sense of how to do this, of how to conceptualize cases individually, how to hear the narrative of a client and look at what is or isn't most important to that person. So there's a readiness for growth. And eventually, the movement towards that third stage of development is what we call integration. This is a place of flexibility. This is a place where a supervisee is able to see problems from many angles. It's just not a linear conceptualization. They have a broader conceptualization of cases, a broader understanding, and a sense of direction. They have a sober judgment of both their strengths and weaknesses. So what I'd like to do is kind of look through a few different models. So as I entitled this seminar, Supervision, about different ways of conceptualizing, my hope today was to provide these different models so that you can kind of keep all of those in the back of your mind at once as you deal with supervisees, or if you are a supervisee yourself, when you're looking at where you're at developmentally in certain areas and what you might need from a supervisor. So one of the names that you might find in the literature is the name Bernard. He has come up with this model that's called the discrimination model. And instead of it being 1, 2, 3 step by step, he looks at three areas that are simultaneously at work in the life of any of our supervisees or in the supervision process. One of the focus areas that he looks at is intervention skills. So ideas like how do I do a diagnostic interview? How do I do treatment planning? How do I define a concrete behavioral goal? What does that look like? How do I empathize with the client, meet him or her where they're at in their narrative, but then use things like reflections, probes, restatement of things, summaries or interpretations? How do I look at not just their verbals, but also their nonverbals to just decide what interventions are the best? A second area Bernard also looks at going on simultaneously is what he calls conceptualization skills. How do I hear the client concerns, do the goal setting, and match up what this particular client needs with what theories are best? How do I not just affirm client movement forward, but keep reconceptualizing and reevaluating the goals and the gains made? How do I reevaluate what we are working towards? Does that change over time? What does that look like? And then are there any common threads throughout the experience with the client? Any themes, any issues that maybe need to be brought to attention? And the third of the three different skill areas that Bernard talks about in his discrimination model is called personalization skills. So this is how to hear feedback non-defensively, whether it be from the clients or whether it be from the supervisor, how to self-analyze and learn, how to combine one's personal style of goals with client goals, and how to develop a professional identity. We also have another model I wanted to present to you, which is a model by Nelson, Johnson, and Thorngren. This is called the integrated approach to supervision. Now, with their approach, they are talking about four different stages, but not so much linear step-by-step stages, but ongoing simultaneous stages that are happening. One is orientation, so setting of the goals and responsibilities for supervision. With that, they're looking at that the supervisor is both a counselor and a teacher in terms of role. Again, let me clarify that counselor doesn't mean that the supervisor should be the clinical counselor for the supervisee, but more that the process variables are strong, that the supervisor is empathizing and relating on high levels of the process variables, as well as teaching and providing didactic direction. Another area in this integrated approach to supervision is that of doing the work of counseling. So skill development. And then we talk about transitions towards more independent thinking, more cooperation and collaboration. This becomes less about teaching or specific answers and more about the consultant model, where again, we have a more experienced and less experienced clinician walking side by side in supervision. And then finally, moving towards integration. Let me say again, as I highlighted earlier, that integration doesn't mean that there's no supervision happening and I finally achieved that I have my independent license. It means that while I'm self-observing and adjusting as needed, I do keep things in check. I do have colleagues that I check in with. Now, Erickson has his stages of development, and these parallel the stages of development of people in general. You'll hear the same exact names in what I say, but they really have to do with supervision as opposed to just life development. So if you recall, his first stage of development is trust versus mistrust. Remember when he talked about that with infants and them trying to figure out who they could trust? Well, there's a parallel level of this with regards to supervision. A supervisee who's relatively inexperienced comes in like trying to figure out, engage, gosh, with my level of anxiety, where am I at? What can I trust? What do I really think about this supervisor? I'm not sure. And just like the infant and the general trust versus mistrust stage of Erickson is trying to gauge and look back and forth between them and the parent, the supervisee is kind of trying to gauge, what do I think about all this with my supervisor? Then after the trust versus mistrust stage of Erickson, we have the next stage is autonomy versus shame and doubt. So over time, remember I talked about skill building and skill development. So we're essentially helping supervisees pursue new tasks without criticism or without too much harshness. So some independent skill and decision making. And over time, we're creating new learning opportunities for them. So think of a young child, you know, as they learn to tie their shoes and make decisions for themselves and they want to show what they know. This is kind of like the supervisee after they pass that initial stage of total uncertainty and awkwardness where they have initiative versus guilt. It's how they respond to these new learning activities. Then there's a movement towards what Erickson calls industry versus inferiority, where the supervisee starts to develop a sense of who does he or she want to be professionally? What does that look like and how do I get there? Once the professional has been in the field several years or had a level of experience where they start to get to what we talked about, that stage of, oh, maybe I have helped. Maybe there is a difference I've made. Maybe there's something I can build on. They progress to the stage of identity versus role confusion. After that, they go to the stage of intimacy versus isolation, which is basically a stage of ongoing commitment to the professional or competitiveness and combative character. Finally, when we're talking about someone who is more in the consultant mode, we're talking about someone who's been seasoned, who has a relative comfort level, but also knows when to consult with colleagues if need be. So they're moving towards generativity versus stagnation. They're looking not just at their professional development, but developing care for the next generation of counselors. If you remember Adler also has a model of supervision, and his is not necessarily sequential either. He talks about it being fluid and process-oriented. He talks about the importance of experiential learning, so this trial and error process. Again, many of the people who look at this idea of supervision look at it from the area of not step by step as much as something happens in the process of doing this over time. So to that end, one of the most valuable parts of supervision is providing honest feedback with respect, addressing hypothetical scenarios. One of the elements of the Adlerian model of supervision that's highlighted is goals. So there's several goals at work at once. We have the goals of the supervisee. What is that person wanting to learn? How are they wanting to meet the criteria for school, for the board, for their licensure level, for the agency? What are the goals of the supervisor? Of course, there's the liability. There's the client care. There's other areas. What are the client's goals? We have simultaneous goal development working at once and simultaneous outcomes. And how do we negotiate this? And then how do we reevaluate it over time? Adler also highlights another area in his model of supervision that's called social interest. So social interest, if you kind of remember in the ethics seminar, is somewhat like social justice in the sense of how do we provide access to resources and therapy that would benefit clients? How do we evaluate the counseling style and goals and make sure it's a good match? So looking at the supervisee's lifestyle orientation, personal beliefs and values and opinions, and how that fits in with what the client's going through. In addition, Adler looks at the counseling style. Things like, are the goals rational and realistic? Are they attainable? What are the assumptions about counseling process? And what is the clinician's self-concept? He talks about reforming goals throughout the process again and making sure there's an aspect of encouragement. One of the models I really like is called the synergistic model of supervision. And I know this may sound heavy on giving you information on theories, but my goal again is that I think there's different pieces that each of the theories highlight. And when we're having a developmental stage of a supervisee, plus our own worldview and experiences as a supervisor, plus an agency or a board layered on top of that, we have several things going at once. And if we can pull different aspects from these different theories, I really think our sense of vision in terms of supervision can be the most clear. So this next synergistic model looks at having a balance between the content and process orientations. So there's three elements that are central to this. We have something called Bloom's taxonomy, which you might be aware of if you have any background in the education world, which I'll explain that in a minute. We have an area called the heuristic model of interpersonal development and multicultural competencies, which are all at the same time happening. With Bloom's taxonomy, the idea is initially when someone's inexperienced in a learning about something, the thing we want to quiz or test or evaluate is first of all things like knowledge and comprehension. So at the basic level, did they get it? Can they define this? Then as they move into deeper levels, maybe more experience in working in counseling, maybe better understanding of how to apply theories, maybe a broader conceptualization, they can move more towards application, meaning using what they know in situations and breaking down the material into parts and analyzing it. And finally, at the more advanced levels, they can move to how do they integrate several different things at once or how do they evaluate material. So there's cumulative levels. If I ask someone, what does cognitive behavioral therapy mean? What does it entail? I'm asking for knowledge and recall. I'm asking for just basic understanding. I'm not saying that person can demonstrate what cognitive behavioral therapy is. But then moving to the next level in Bloom's taxonomy, it would be a step further. That person would not be able to just name and define like a textbook what CBT is, but they would also be able to show how they could apply that level of CBT to a given client situation. And then finally, they might be able to kind of hypothesize about, oh, how might I work with a client with CBT on such and such issue versus another approach? How could I compare and contrast those? So the idea being with the synergistic model of supervision that based on the client's developmental level, we're progressing from more basic levels to more advanced conceptualization and matching where the client sat and then hopefully gradually taking him or her to a deeper level. This heuristic model of development looks at areas like how do I adapt to client stereotypes? How do I challenge beliefs? How do I negotiate when there's tension between what I think, what a client thinks, what the agency might believe? How do I work within differences? And this also combines with the multicultural competencies. Remember what I mentioned earlier, that culture is the way any group of people do something. So what's great about the synergistic model is that we have these layers of experience and knowledge and case conceptualization, as well as individual worldview and culture all layered together. So it really does make for something becoming very individualized to a client. I've given some examples in the PowerPoint slides of how this might measure out. So for example, if you were working with a supervisee in the knowledge, the first step of the synergistic model, you might say, what is the cognitive behavioral model? Name who founded the cognitive behavior model. What do you know about this? Define it. Then moving to a little bit greater level, you'd move to the level of comprehension. Describe how the cognitive behavioral model conceptualizes things. What do you think the cognitive behavioral approach may work better with? What type of clients could benefit from this? Then as you get to the next level, possible applications. Demonstrate an example of how this may work with such and such client. Then even greater level might be analyze, compare and contrast this technique with another technique. Or integrate this with working with a client with such and such situation. Appraise the benefits or the costs to using this. So you see how more is required at each level. Another type of supervision is what they call the wellness model of supervision. This talks about the idea of wellness being both a process and an outcome. And we know that if we don't prevent burnout, if there isn't wellness, it can impact both the supervisee, it can impact the client they're counseling, the supervisor can be impacted, the whole dynamic can be impacted. So supervisors can be role models in terms of modeling wellness. So I like to look at, just like we do with clients, what is the concrete, observable behavioral definition of wellness for that person. So the supervisee might have one idea, supervisor or the client might have another. But looking at what that means and how do we get there? One of the other things I found interesting in the literature is they had some literature on the expressive arts, meaning artistic ways of working through different clinical issues in group supervision. And I found this fascinating. I've cited the article in the literature here, this 2005 article, where sometimes supervisees, when they didn't know how to put things into words, they could do better sometimes in a group supervision using visuals, using colors, painting, drawing, using music, using symbolism to talk about some of the struggles they go through, some of the issues, some of the questions. So even through this, when art was used in a group supervision context, the supervisees were able to highlight some of the same struggles they were going through, some of the problem solving, some of the solutions. Some of the interesting things with the expressive arts where this helped was looking at the counseling images and then reassessing over time. So let's say maybe you have a supervisee or a group of supervisees in a group setting make a picture or draw something or cut out or make a collage about what is their image of self as counselor when they're first starting the practicum. Then maybe at various stages, how does that change over time? Another area that could be looked at is counselor identity. just the journey of who they are. Things like overcoming obstacles. Maybe you could fold a paper, for example, into three sections. First one might be where they started out. Then the third one might be where they want to go. And then in the middle, there would be the process and where they believe they're at in terms of getting there, and using group supervision to discuss and explore that. Another way the expressive arts could be used in group supervision is to look at symbolic representations of growth, things that represent the journey. Sometimes, just like it's easier for our clients to talk in terms of metaphor, it might be easier sometimes in supervision for supervisees to talk about those metaphor. Gestalt supervision groups focus a lot on trying to process in the here and now and expanding that awareness, so that at several times there could be one thing going on within a supervisee. There could be in a group setting a few people experiencing a similar thing, or the whole group experiencing that. And those being types of things that could be brought up within the supervision. There's also something which I find fascinating. You know, some of these later or newer, more recent types of supervision approaches called video journaling. So with this, they're looking at raw in-the-moment reactions. They're considering supervision as a type of reflective practice. So dealing with the complexities and intricacies, where initially someone might be just kind of brainstorming and talking, instead of writing down in a journal, they're just videotaping their thoughts aloud about what they might anticipate at a given stage of development as a supervisee. And then overall, as they progress, there might be various times throughout the quarter or semester in school where they might use this journaling, and then there might be even journal writing assigned in between that. So when we're looking at the development, what's the ultimate goal, regardless of the models that we're using? When we're talking about a sense of vision and forward movement and supervision, what are we working towards? Well, Fallander and Shafransky in 2021 basically came up with a list of what they would see as the endpoints of supervision. One being professionalism, so the values and ethics of our profession. Reflectivity, being self-aware. Scientific mindedness, so kind of looking at, okay, what is appropriate, what is effective work in what we're doing. Relationship skills amongst the different dynamics, the supervisee and the client, the supervisee and the supervisor and the agency, the supervisee and the agency, all these different dynamics. Then multicultural competency, how to really individualize therapy to each situation that has an array of individual differences. How to collaborate with teams, and how to skill, build, and develop. Three considerations when we're deciding what type of task we should give supervisees and where they're at developmentally. There's three areas we're really wanting to assess. How autonomous can this person be? Are they really ready to make these decisions on their own, and to what degree? How complex is the task? Are they ready for this? And issues of vulnerability and risk. We also want to foster, over the client's development, their ability to self-evaluate. So there are some questions I've listed towards that that may also be questions that the supervisee might want to think about before he or she comes into supervision. Things like, what formative needs do I have? What do I think and feel about this client? How can I conceptualize this case? What theories might explain this case? Or what techniques are are empirically supported. What professional, legal, ethical, or moral considerations are there? Any administrative procedures, documentation, or record keeping? Areas that the supervisor might need to be aware of, or just self-care? So the literature talks about what are the things that are considered positive characteristics of a supervisee, and what are some of the positive characteristics of a supervisor. And I wanted to basically give you an overview of what are the outstanding things that seem to repeat themselves in the literature. So in terms of positive supervisee dynamics, one of the things that was highlighted was just understanding. So the desire to learn, the willingness to mature. So even if there's things that the supervisee doesn't initially know, the willingness to grow, to learn, to ask questions, even with a vulnerability. The willingness to progress towards more autonomous stages of development. To know what they know, essentially, and to know what they don't know or need to learn, which I think is embodied in this next one, wisdom. Motivation to keep moving forward. Willingness to keep evaluating in terms of self-awareness and openness. Supervisors tend to prefer supervisees have that interest and desire, that they're motivated to learn, that they have a sense of interpersonal curiosity, that they're psychologically minded, there's an enthusiasm, an eagerness, a dependability, and empathy. They also prefer that supervisees are willing to continue to grow, that they take responsibility for their behavior. So even if there's something they don't know, or maybe they aren't applying, quote, properly, that they're transparent about that. They participate in discussions, and they're able to do that by hearing constructive criticism, by having introspection and minimal defensiveness, that they're receptive to feedback. Now, the literature not only highlights positive supervisee qualities, but also highlights positive supervisor qualities. One of them, which sounds very common sense to me, but is worth saying, is availability and approachability. All too often, I've seen situations where someone's wanting to ask questions, but they can't find a supervisor. I remember one place I used to work at, a colleague had told me she left a note in the director's mailbox, and weeks and weeks and weeks went by and never got a return phone call. So it's like, you know, basically supervisee wants to know, how do I get in contact with the supervisor? So that's where that, what do we call it, the contract at the beginning is really important, you know, is how do I have these discussions? Are they scheduled and planned times? What if I need something in between? So supervisees wanted to see someone who was available, approachable, who helped give them suggestions, who provided regular and consistent feedback, including suggestions for improvement. They also preferred someone who tried to restrict the relationship primarily to supervision. So minimizing some of those administrative functions and outside things, and who really was a role model for them, who modeled, who coached, offered emotional support and reassurance, and gave positive feedback. Now, there is an interesting article I found out there that highlighted the ingredients of supervisor failure. And I think a lot of times when we go to these seminars on supervision, it focuses so heavily on the supervisee. But I think one of the keys is also allowing for a level of analysis, whether it's self-evaluation or a level of feedback from the supervisee to the supervisor. So let me go over some of these elements that this literature showed were linked to supervisor failure. Things like denigrating the supervisory relationship, just minimizing the importance of it as a tool for development for both people. Demonstrating incompetence multiculturally or just a narrow-mindedness. Modeling unethical behaviors. Again, we can't assume just because someone's more experienced that they necessarily are the most ethical role model. Another area where supervisors might fail is using evaluation instruments that could not pass for an undergraduate thesis. Teaching your trainee how to be narcissistic, so the power struggles and supervisors using that to really capitalize on the performance anxiety supervisees feel. Applying psychotherapy models and supervision as if there was a theoretical or empirical basis. Infantilizing your trainees. Colluding with your trainees. Trying to be a therapist to the supervisee. Or having a dual relationship with the supervisee. Supervisors can be unbalanced. They can have difficulties with misjudging the developmental level of a supervisee. And keep in mind, if you do find yourself in that, it's just like if we misjudge the therapeutic goals with a client, we go back and we reevaluate. There's a lot to be said for humility and saying, oh, I misunderstood this. Okay, let me check in. Let me see if I can hear it better now. So going back, also keep in mind that just because a supervisee is at a developmental level that's maybe it's lower in one area, doesn't mean they're necessarily at an early stage in all areas. Or just because they're advanced in one area, doesn't mean they're necessarily advanced in all areas. Some things that they encourage supervisors to work on are to really try and be more flexible, to be tolerant of differences, just like we are with clients, to be able to model, to get the training that we need to be able to adequately supervise. One of the acronyms they use that I think is interesting is called FLAVORS. So each of those letters in the acronym FLAVORS means something. FLAVORS. So F, and this can help the supervisee, the supervisor, or just the supervision relationship in general. F means focusing or keep focused on client goals. We can't go wrong again if we're focused on what the client's coming to us about. What is his or her narrative? How do they believe they got to the presenting concerns? What do they believe are the ways of defining them or healing them? What do they believe is contributing to their stresses, and what do they believe is part of the solution? L is listening. Just like I said, there's Rogers process variables. Here we go again. Empathy and respectfulness are both part of listening. So focusing, listening. A is assessing. Assessing for strengths, resilience, and interests. While we tend to hyper-focus on the evaluative nature of supervision, just like in counseling, there's a lot to be said for more of a solution-focused, strengths-based approach. That can be a lot more motivating, which leads us to V, which is validating the resources and moving towards possible growth. O, openly sharing. R, replacing. So gathering creative solutions, gathering information, and S, Socratic dialogue. So again, the focus on the process more than stages of development. So focusing, listening, assessing, validating, openly sharing, replacing, and Socratic dialogue. One of the things I think is important for us to highlight is supervisory self-care. I have had a seminar I've taught in the past regarding this, that one of the things that is important is to realize that the stresses of supervisors and the supervisory process can mirror the stresses in the counseling process. So the time demands, the emotional demands, it's really important to kind of count that cost before someone decides to engage in a supervision relationship. So some ways of considering that towards that end are to look at, are there any unresolved issues that might need to be addressed? One of the things I know the literature talks a lot about is vicarious traumatization. Let's say we have some rough cases. If there's unresolved issues, how am I going to deal with those cases? How am I going to, you know, are they going to re-trigger me? Is that going to hinder me from being in the present? Another thing that I know I've said before, but I can't highlight enough, is making sure that we all, whether we're at earlier stages of development or we're more seasoned, that we have a network of other counselors to speak with. This ethically is helpful, but also it develops a scope of practice and it helps us because it's hard for us to self-evaluate accurately, but when we have that network, we can bounce things off people. We can't minimize with self-care. We can't minimize enough those basic foundations of eating, sleeping, health, wellness, just consistency. I always joke about how I know that sometimes we can say things to clients or to others, but sadly, I think sometimes when we're in the helping profession, we tend to be some of the worst people about self-care. I remember the one practice I was at, people would just either have, you know, energy drinks or little candy bars or things in between clients and basically not eat or sleep the days that they saw clients, that they were so intensely focused on that. And that really does convey a message to clients or in supervision. So again, wellness needs to not just be a result, but a process and something that's an ongoing goal for all of us. There needs to be balance, work and life balance, to allow space away from the clinical setting. One of the things that can promote burnout is when we tend to see ourselves always as a helper, a caregiver, and a fixer, to where even when we're not on the job, to an extent we're on the job, because our mind is there. We're in that mode. So learning to see ourselves in other types of roles than caretaker and caregiver. And not feeling guilty or feeling a sense of shame about taking time off. The idea just being that, you know, we're human just as much as the next person. Other things that are practical things that we may want to consider are things like that supervisory contract or an agency contract. The more things are specific and we know what to expect, it's in writing, we know how it's measured, and we have concrete behavioral goals, the easier and better and more positive the outcomes tend to be. Also, when there's appropriate fees charged, whether there's fees for client contact and counseling, whether we're talking about supervision fees, or agency fees, there's something to be said for feeling respected for your time, your expertise, and what you're doing. That does make a difference. Self-care also involves making sure there's competency, that professional development, that your continuing education is up to date, that the expectations are clear, and that there's a plan for what to do at the end of the day when work is done, and how to keep those areas where, again, there's that work and life balance. One of the things that commonly is brought up is how to deal with a crisis when there's supervision. And crisis doesn't have to mean that everything's going to fall apart. A crisis time, let's say a client needs a higher level of care, it gives a time for us, again, to reevaluate goals. It actually can be helpful. It doesn't have to be a bad thing. Crisis can have what's called a restorative function. Supervision can provide that restorative function when there is a crisis. For one, it can normalize the experience that there are times that sometimes the client needs or the situation just requires a higher level of care, or that things do need to, on an ongoing basis, need to be reevaluated and processed, or that not all the protocols or procedures of an agency really are adequate to cover certain types of issues. So crisis basically brings home the idea that we need to reevaluate. It can help us know what we need more knowledge on. It can help us realize that we need to get more information on community resources, or that maybe we need to reevaluate wellness and what that looks like, work-life balance, skill development. Crisis needs to be reevaluated because it can trigger unresolved conflicts. It can create pressure. It can require rapid behavior de-escalation. It can be complex. And crisis isn't always the same among everybody. It can look different in different ways. But it can be an opportunity for growth. And that's where that contract, again, that I mentioned earlier is really important, because that can help a supervisee and supervisor know what do we do when we get to one of these points. This is important because the literature shows that when supervisees think they've made mistakes, that a lot of times they intentionally will not disclose certain information, like their mistakes, or maybe not documenting certain things, or if there's risk things, especially if they've operated at an inappropriate level of autonomy. So we want to create an environment in which the supervisee, if they realize they might have made mistakes, could come to us. Some of the common reasons they say they don't is because they want to avoid confrontation and because of the shame they're feeling. You know, keep in mind the supervisee is already being evaluated. So they're thinking, oh, great, you know, now this, you know, could be used against me. But if it's structured right, then it can be used as a tool for development. One of, I think, the single most important things that has helped supervisees has been what these next few slides highlight. Types of examples of questions of how a supervisee could come to a supervisor, or ways, like what I would call lead-ins, of how to ask a supervisor for help. Again, sometimes we don't know what we don't know, and we're not sure how to put it into words. So some of these questions can be meaningful. So things like, can you give me some ideas about how to avoid giving advice when clients keep asking me what to do? Would you mind reviewing my paperwork? Where can I find resources on a certain topic? Can you help me explore the feelings I have about this situation? Or, wow, my client reminds me of such and such. How can I work with that? Can we discuss treatment options? How do I build trust or rapport with this client? I'm feeling stuck. Can you give me some guidance? I'm not sure I documented this right. Can you take a look at it and let me know what I should have done? Not sure if I handled this ethical situation correctly. Can I have your guidance? So again, I think providing a supervisee with something like a list of this sort that gives them some lead-ins can really be helpful. There's some guidelines the literature also offers supervisees in terms of how to give feedback, or for supervisors as well, how to give feedback. To listen, even as they're sharing. Again, hearing can do as much as telling. So be concrete. Focus on behaviors so it doesn't sound like a personality attack. Be respectful. Identify both positive and negative aspects. So, you know, skill building and skill development. What's going well? The strengths-based, solution-focused approach, as well as equipping, role modeling, training for new skills. Be constructive. So if we're going to say, oh, that something maybe isn't the right way of doing things, we need to also be able to look at, and what's the alternative? We also want to make sure we don't overload the supervisee with too many critical points at once. And look at realistic changes. What are things that someone can do something about? We don't want to make something so overwhelming that it's so hard to make a change about it, but looking at what is the person able to do. And when presenting feedback, it needs to be presented as a consideration. I work with clients on how to use gentle lead-ins. And I think that could be a valuable skill even when it comes to supervision. Things like, would you be willing to consider trying a different approach that might be more in line with what the literature shows is helpful for this population? Supervisors are encouraged to also self-evaluate. Just because someone's a supervisor doesn't mean that they're necessarily doing all the right or most helpful things. So it would be useful for a supervisor when having this supervision that I've highlighted today to look at how they might be contributing to problems. How is the supervisee contributing to problems? What is working or what's not working? Again, there's probably some of both. It's not either or. And how can we reframe the situation into an opportunity for growth? Hopefully in the long run, we're facilitating both professionals looking at things as a sort of reflective practice. So we're facilitating ongoing professional development. One of the quotes I thought was good said, "Reflection is the process of engaging the self in attentive, critical, exploratory interactions with one's thoughts and actions and their underlying conceptual frame with a view to changing them and the change itself." That's an interesting way of looking at it. What are we reflecting on then? We can reflect on our competencies, our knowledge base. Is there anything that we need to learn more about? What ability we have to take on new situations, our awareness of our thoughts, our feelings, and the impact different types of clients or situations have on us, and our abilities to problem solve. Now, I did want to go through some multicultural considerations because there is a importance in the literature to highlight various aspects of a client. Cultural competency has to do with relinquishing absolute truths or ideas that we have about the way things should be done and learning to accept multiple perspectives. It also involves critically analyzing techniques and interventions to choose ones that are the best fit for a given client. We talked a lot about Roger's process variables, so it involves hearing how someone's cultural traditions, values, beliefs, and worldviews affect their intrapersonal and interpersonal interactions. This multicultural competency idea is nonetheless important in supervision. We should be providing as much as it's an opportunity to supervision with various groups. Groups of people who have different worldviews on different topics. We should help develop self-awareness of variables, challenge stereotypes and assumptions, and learn how to broach topics. The literature talks about the elements of successful multicultural supervision. They actually got a group of several professionals together, and they did something called a Delphi poll. What that is they put these professionals all in a room and asked them the question, what is successful multicultural supervision? And for hours and hours, these professionals had to talk with each other until they came up with some agreed upon foundations for the definition of successful multicultural supervision. So I want to share with you some of the things that they highlighted that were key. One being tending to the feelings of discomfort experienced by trainees concerning multicultural issues. Supporting supervisees' own racial, ethnic, or identity development. Tolerating feelings like anger, rage, or fear surrounding multicultural issues. Providing supervisees multiculturally diverse caseload to help them broach different types of clinical experiences. Then looking at the degree to which some of these tensions play out in the parallel process, not just between the client and supervisee, but between the supervisee and supervisor. So we're talking about things about checking out expectations, encouraging supervisees and supervisors to share about their background and experiences, but also to maintain boundaries so that's not, in an unethical sense, influencing the relationship with clients, acknowledging where we have lack of knowledge on differences, and testing hypotheses so things aren't just one certain way. Sometimes it might be a matter of self-disclosing our own areas of our cultural background and what we might need to learn more on, and basically sharing with the client the approach of, you know, help me, teach me, show me what's different or what's off or what can I learn from, and then be willing to broaden our experience. Keep in mind that there's multiple cultural identities intersecting at once. A 2021 article by Fallander and Safransky highlights what they call a multicultural ecological approach. Again, we're looking at that the context, the environmental demands, and the settings are all weighing at once. I also want to talk about ethical considerations, because these are important in terms of our responsibility to a supervisee, not just to help them learn techniques and treatment planning, but to help them learn what's ethically appropriate. So we can look at values, the ethical values of things like benefiting the public and society and promoting well-being. So beneficence, doing good, and then non-maleficence, not doing harm. We can look at the value of fidelity and responsibility, honoring one's commitments and responsibilities, having professional conduct, being a person of integrity, justice and fairness, having respect and dignity for the worth of all in spite of differences, and being competent. We can look at things like the framework of justice, wisdom, being temperate, having courage to face things. There are some danger signals that when they're there, whether it's between a supervisor and a supervisee or with a client, can be a red flag. These are the ones I wanted to make sure that we're aware of, or that maybe we create some discussion with the supervisee about, so that when these things potentially happen, it helps us to think like, something's here that I need to pause about and reconsider. One of them is flattery. While we are in an evaluative component with supervision, we want to make sure to avoid the extremes of flattery or just being ultra critical. Flattery can breed an uncomfortable closeness and can create dual relationships or put someone at risk for an unethical type of situation. Other danger signals include things like seductive behavior or desire to discuss sexual issues, complaints about loneliness, physical familiarity. So again, just that sense of closeness beyond just the collegial contacts about clients and about the work we're doing. We want to really focus on the therapeutic goals. One of the things that also can be a danger signal, so we have to be aware of, is overdependence. And this is tricky because, as we spoke about earlier, supervisees are at various levels of development. There's time where early on they may need more training. They may need more of that didactic approach. There's probably going to be more dependence. But we also need to couch that dependence in a reasonable setting of goals. So just like we would with client goals and treatment planning, we want to make sure that in our documentation and in the supervision interactions that we're focused on the concrete behavioral goals and what to do to reach them. Another danger signal, just like it could be a danger signal with a client, but could be a danger signal with supervision, is gift giving. Again, it creates a dynamic that can be a little bit more on the friendly, personal level than the, you know, supervisor, supervisee level. Other things that might be red flags to watch out for: if you're having thoughts about a client, a supervisor, or supervisee between sessions, if you're thinking about them, they're taking up, as I would say, residence in your head, or they're taking up time, that could predispose you to ethical issues or could some danger signals, whether it's admiration, whether it's thoughts of anger and frustration about things not going a certain way, just having a frequency of thoughts that's excess, or comparing them to someone else. Especially if you're having fantasies or seeing the other person as quote unquote special in some sort of way. If you're having times where you feel like you need to make more time for them, that you're making excuses to actually extend more contact with them, or if the time that's supposed to be spent for supervision, for conceptualization of cases, for training, for diagnosis and treatment of clinical client issues is being spent on more personal stuff, that could be a danger signal. So these are things we want to watch out for. Supervisees may feel threatened again. They're at a situation where they do have very real evaluation they're facing. So there are some real sources of threats for them. There's the evaluation anxiety, performance anxiety, personal problems or internal conflicts that they may be having. You know, maybe they're having to juggle school, family life, their own personal time, clinical internship. They might feel threatened by what they think are deficits in the supervisory relationship. There might be fear of negative consequences if they try something new and it doesn't work out as well as they'd like. And then there's the power imbalance. Excuse me. So, one of the things we can do, if you're in a supervisory position, is you have a unique ability to reduce a supervisee's overall sense of threat. You can restructure how you give feedback so that, again, it's not just focusing on the lack or the areas of development where they need growth, but looking at reframing things as opportunities for growth. So where they feel vulnerable, where they feel like they're under the spotlight, it actually can be something where you can reframe it as a tool for moving forward. You can assess strengths. You can build support systems. So possibly helping a supervisee link to other colleagues in the community, other resources, information about working with certain types of clients, classes on skill development. So really building those things. So it communicates the message to the supervisee. I believe in you. I want to help you mature in this process. We're in this together in a supervision way. The other thing we can do is increase the ratio of positive to negative feedback. We can modify our supervision style. Just like I tell clients when I'm working with them in counseling, I always say everything's modifiable. We can try some new techniques, and let's say we find out certain parts of them don't work the way we hope. We can modify them. We can get rid of them. We can change when and how we do them. There's a lot of things you can reevaluate. But it's similar with the supervision relationship. If we find out maybe we mis-evaluated the level of development that a supervisee is at, we can reevaluate that. If we find out there's things we overlooked or maybe something we need to speak about that we didn't, we can modify that. We also can be aware of noting things that where we're seeing that the supervisee might have defensive reactions, as well as noting the areas where they've performed or where there's things that they've done well. So again, this clinical supervision relationship is just fascinating. We have the ability to change our vision for the interaction. We have the ability to rework the goals and the dynamics. And there's a really interesting way that supervisors can role model this. We can reconceptualize our approaches to supervision by looking at the developmental level the supervisee's at, by looking at a host of these different areas, by having more of a strengths-based focus while answering questions and supporting development. Again, it's a partnership. As I mentioned earlier, while the supervisees may be asking for training and asking direct questions about how to deal with certain types of clients and asking for more of a didactic approach, there is something to be said for the movement towards basically asking the supervisees, you know, to come alongside us in this journey, that it's a supervisory-like partnership. And as I stated in the first section of today's seminar, we, at all levels, can highlight, both verbally, but as well in the contract, the boundaries and the expectations for the supervisor, the supervisee, the client, the agency. And those can be reevaluated, reworked, changed we can write an addendum. Again, this doesn't have to be a stressful journey, but it can be one of being reevaluated as we go along. The vision can be reworked. So one of the things I'd like to do as we return in this, in the third and last portion of today's seminar, I want to discuss through some possible examples here. So you might want to have some paper and pencil or just, you know, have some time to brainstorm as we go through some potential supervision types of situations and think about how you can apply some of what we talked about today or what you already know or have experienced about how we might approach those things.